by seeing if there's any questions about what we've been doing so far.
Can I ask like an unrelated question, kind of?
Sure. I reserve the right to decline to answer it, but.
So when Patrick Hayden says that black holes have 1 cubic per Planck area,
yeah,
what is he saying?
So the black hole entropy is, you know, in Planck units, area over 4. The area of the horizon. And so we haven't really talked about entropy in this class, but entropy can be used as a measure of information content of a number of different states. So in the simplest case, where you have a system where all of the states are equally populated, and the entropy is just the log of the number of states.
Yeah.
And so if it has that much entropy, then if you want to think of it as a quantum system with, you know, some set of states, then that's how many states it could have, roughly, or that's how many qubits it could have. The entropy is the log of the number of states, right, which is the number of qubits that you would need to have that many states.
I'm wondering more, in general, in continuous variable systems, can you describe them in terms of like qubits per volume or qubits per area?
So continuous variable systems are tricky because, technically they have an infinite number of qubits. You have a mode, you know, a continuous mode. It has infinitely many states. And so you have an infinite number of qubits that you would need to totally describe that. But again, that's assuming infinite precision. So if you put, you know, ultraviolet and infrared cutoffs on everything, then you're back down to a finite number of degrees of freedom. And in the context of black hole entropy, that's kind of the assumption that's going on, that there's some kind of Planck scale cutoff that limits you to a finite number of degrees of freedom. If you calculate the entanglement entropy across the horizon, it's infinite. Okay.
The entanglement entropy between what?
Of the vacuum state, say around the black hole. The vacuum, which does have Hawking radiation in it, but it depends. You know, any variety of states you can look at will have infinite entropy over the horizon. And actually, that's true in flat space. If you look at the vacuum of quantum field theory in flat space, you divide into two regions, again, you'll get infinite entanglement entropy. But again, this is a quantity that one assumes has to be renormalized. And so you kind of work from there. But again, the easiest way to think about it is, again, just imagine putting cutoffs on everything. And the number of degrees of freedom is finite and it's proportional to, I guess, black hole proportional to theory.
The entropy is infinite, or the entropy density is infinite? Because the entropy is okay for it to be infinite, right?
For a black hole,
yeah.
I mean, so you're, if you have a finite region here, so the surface area is finite,
yeah,
and it's still infinite, right? So the density or it doesn't matter, right? There's, you're dividing by a finite, if you wanted to look at the density, you're dividing by a finite area anyway. That's not that, you know, it's not that you're dealing with infinite volumes or anything like that that makes this happen. It's the fact that you're dealing with arbitrarily high frequency modes that connect the two sides. Okay, so are there questions that are more related to what we're doing in class? Okay. So last time I talked about complexity, and I talked about, in particular, about RSA and how it's a public key crypto system. And so now I want to describe exactly how RSA works. Well, not exactly how it works, but the main points of how it works. And in particular, how it's related to factoring. And then we'll talk about how Shor's algorithm gives a quantum algorithm to break RSA. So, Okay, so the name RSA comes from the inventors. And the way it works is this. So you have the key generation step. So in this one, I guess the way I was describing it, Bob was the one that was going to have the private key, but he has to generate the pair, public key and private key. So Bob chooses two large primes. P and Q. And so the number that this is going to be based around is P times Q. And he chooses some other number, E, that's less than N, and finds a D with this property. X to the E times D is equal to X mod N for all X. Okay? And I'm going to tell you in a little bit how you can choose that D. Or find that D, I should say. So then given this key generation, the private key is D, okay? That's all you really need to decrypt, along with the public key, I suppose. The public key is the pair N and E. Okay. And so how do you do the encryption and decryption? So the encryption could only use the public key, remember? And the way it works is, suppose we have a message X. Ciphertext will be this. Y is X to the E mod N, okay? So we're gonna imagine putting our message into a form where it's just a number, and it has to be a number less than n. If you have a bigger number, you can break it up into pieces. And actually, this is not exactly what you do either, but I'll come back to that in a minute. Okay. So then to decrypt, well, Bob could use D, and he has this property about E and D. And so given some ciphertext Y, so he'll decrypt it to X prime, which is just going to be Y to the D mod N. And so the reason this gives us back the right answer is because if Y is a valid ciphertext, so it was generated by Alice using this algorithm, then X prime is X to the E to D mod N, which by this property is just X. Okay, so Bob gets back the message. Okay, is all of that clear? Okay, so how does Bob find D? So this relies on an old results from number theory called Euler's theorem. And this is based around the totient function. Which is the number of positive integers, which are less than n. Is it less than or less than or equal to? Yeah, less than, I guess it doesn't really matter. Because of the second condition, and relatively prime to n. Okay. So for instance, phi of a prime number is p minus 1. Because 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 up to p minus 1, none of them have common factors with p. Okay. And in fact, there's a relatively straightforward formula for phi of n in terms of the prime factorization of n. And so in particular, the case that we're interested in, phi of p times q is p minus 1 times q minus 1. Okay. Now this, of course, is not the theorem. This is just the preliminary to the theorem. The theorem says that for all x less than n, x to the phi of n is equal to 1 mod n. Okay. So for the case of n being prime, this is saying that x to the p minus 1 is equal to 1 mod n, or x to the p is equal to p mod n. And so that's a result that is a simpler, a special case of this, Fermat's little theorem, that is pretty well known. You might have seen that before. This one you might have seen before too. It's hardly an obscure theorem. But in any case, this theorem you see gives us the key to finding this pair here, because if d times e is equal to 1 mod phi of n, then then that means that x to the d times e is saying that d times e is some multiple of phi of n plus 1. Okay, so this is equal to x to the c times phi of n plus 1. And then if we look at this mod n, well, this is x times x to the c phi of n. And x to the c phi of n is 1 to the c. So this is equal to x mod n. Okay? So this is our goal, to find d and e that that when you multiply them together, you get something that's 1 mod phi of n. And phi of n, we know, it's p minus 1 times q minus 1. Bob knows anyway. Okay? I'm not actually going to tell you how to do this right now, because it's a problem in the tutorial. And so you'll work out, the problem in yesterday's tutorial, in fact. Right? Euclid's algorithm. Yes. So using Euclid's algorithm, you can find this set of things, right? Because let's see. So Euclid's algorithm says that if you have two numbers that are relatively prime, then there exists constants such that a times one plus b times another is equal to 1. Right? And so if e and phi of n are relatively prime, then there's some constant such that d times e plus c times 5n, or I guess minus c times 5n, is equal to 1. Right? So by finding those two constants, you're finding, and then keeping the one that's the coefficient of e, you found the appropriate d. Okay? Of course, Euclid's algorithm might give you something that's, you know, too big or too small, but then you can scale it down. I mean, it's not going to be too big, but you can get negative numbers certainly, and so you might have to scale up by, you know, one adding 5n to one time in order to put it between 0 and 5n. Okay. So anyway, so that's what Bob does. So he picks some e that's relatively prime to 5n, and then he uses Euclid's algorithm to find d. Okay, is this clear? Okay, so now let me reveal that there's actually a lot more to RSA. Mostly I'm not going to go into. So it turns out, okay, yeah. So first of all, why is this secure? Well, we don't actually know that you have to be able to factor to break RSA. What you really would like to be able to do is, if you wanted to break it, is given this public key to find out the private key, right? But to find out the private key, you have to do the same deduction. Given E, let us find D, right? And well, if you knew 5n, you could do that. So certainly factoring is sufficient to break RSA, right? Because if you knew 5n, you could say, oh, I know if you knew what the prime factorization of n was, you would know what 5n was. And then you could go through the same argument to figure out not necessarily the same d, because there might be more than one, but a d that works. So that would definitely be one way that you could break RSA if you knew how to factor. But if you don't know how to factor, maybe there's still other ways that you could find d without knowing the prime factors of n. None is known. But on the other hand, it's not known that breaking RSA implies that you know how to factor. Okay, so there's a reduction that only goes one direction. And it is also known that if you're not careful about picking E, you might be able to figure out D through some kind of reasonable, I don't know if it's polynomial or just, you know, cractable on existing computers. Method to find D. So you have to be kind of careful about how you pick E and D. And then, since RSA is supposed to be a practical system, you also want to pick values of E and D for which you can do the encryption and decryption relatively fast. And so these are a bunch of considerations that go into actually implementing RSA in a secure way. And similarly, you have to be a little careful about how you pick P and Q. So factoring, in general, seems to be hard for pretty much random values, but it is possible to come up with kind of easy instances where these are both prime. The obvious case would be if, you know, one of them is very small, right? If you pick P is 2, then it's pretty easy to factor. But even when they're both quite large, I think there's some kind of special cases that you can actually run across where it's relatively easy. So the last detail about actually implementing it is I said that you take the message X and you encrypt it this way. But actually, you don't want to do that. Remember yesterday, in response to a question, I commented that a public key crypto system always used randomness as part of the encryption. And the reason for that is suppose that the eavesdropper has narrowed the message down to two possibilities. He knows that, you know, given the situation that they're in, the Alice and Bob are in, that there's only really two possible messages that Alice might be sending, right? Well, then she could very easily break it if you did it this way, right? Because she could say, well, message X1, I'll encrypt and I get Y1. Message X2, I'll encrypt and I'll get Y2. And then Alice sent one of those two things. I just have to compare it, okay? So that would be totally insecure. So instead, what you do is you send a random number here for X and encrypt that, and then use that random number as a private key to encrypt the real message using a private key crypto system, which could be the one-time pad, but is more likely to be something like AES, kind of the modern, most main private key crypto system. Okay? So, don't take what's written on the board and go home and try to write your own encryption system. It's actually much harder than that to really make it work. Yeah, there's a lot of art into finding large primes too. I didn't tell you how to test for primes. Okay? Any other questions about RSA? Okay, so then let's talk about how Shor's algorithm can break RSA. So the first thing is that Shor's algorithm doesn't actually directly factor numbers. Instead, what it does is find the period of functions. So let me first explain how that's related to factoring. So the period finding problem so we have some function from numbers mod n to numbers mod n, and it's a periodic function. And we don't want it to repeat values otherwise. So in particular, that means that f of x, I guess I was using a here, is equal to f of a plus r. And this is mod n addition. F of A is not equal to F of B if B minus A is less than R. Or equivalently, that R does not divide B minus A. Okay? And then the problem, your task, is to, of course, find this period, find R. Okay? And so this is what Shor's algorithm actually, the problem that Shor's algorithm actually solves. Okay, so how is this related to factoring? Well, I'm not going to go through all of the details, but the basic idea is that you can factor if you can find the period of this function or this family of functions. Okay, so you have some base and you raise it to the power a, and well, it has to be periodic because Well, actually, because of Euler's theorem, says that once you raise it to the power 5n, you're getting 1, and then 5n plus 1 will get you back to x, right? So, so this has a period that's at most 5n, but it could, in principle, be a factor of 5n. Because the period is a factor of 5n, it's going to tell you something about the prime factorization of n. So how does that work? Well, so in particular, we want to find x that has even order. And it turns out, through some number theory, that random x has even order with constant probability. So constant, I mean, between 0 and 1, neither of those things. So if you pick a couple of random x's and find their periods, then after a few trials, you'll find one that has an even order. So then you take y, which is x to the r over 2. So this, when r is even, this is going to be something well defined. And in particular, y squared will be 1 mod n. And so if y squared is 1 mod n, then y squared minus 1, which you can factor to y plus 1, y minus 1, is some multiple of n. And so you have a couple of possibilities here. So one possibility is n divides y plus 1. Another possibility is n divides y minus 1. We have p divides y, oh yeah, sorry, three possibilities. P divides y plus 1 and q divides y minus 1. Right, so n is p times q. So, so those prime factors on the right, p and q are prime, they have to go somewhere on the left, right? So either they're both on the same side, and that means that n divides one of these things, or they split. One is on one side and one is on the other side. So this would imply that y is actually equal to 1 mod n, which would say that the order of x was actually r over 2, not r. Okay? So that's not right. So this is not a possibility. So this one can sometimes happen. So this one says that y is minus 1 mod n. But it turns out that that this sometimes happens, but it sometimes doesn't happen. So it's only with constant probability. So if we do happen to get this case, we just keep on going, and eventually we'll pick another x with even order that's not true for.
What is x having even order? What is the order of x?
The order of x is this r, is the period.
Okay.
Well, okay. I guess it's, yeah. I guess only known as the order of in a context like this. Yeah, for the general function, it's not known as the order, but in algebraic contexts like this, it often gets called the order. If you have a a group, the order of an element is the number of times you raise to get one. And that's basically what's going on here. It's not a group, it's a ring, but same idea. Okay, so that leaves this last case. So with constant probability, for each random x we pick, we're going to get this last case. And in this last case, well, we can find so p is then going to be the greatest common divisor of y plus 1 and n. And q will be the greatest common divisor of y minus 1 and n. Okay? And these are, again, things you can calculate using Euclid's algorithm. Okay? So that, and these are the factors then of n. Okay? Is this part here? Okay. So now let's get to the quantum part. Well, let's go back. Okay, so Shor's algorithm. I'm first going to give kind of an overview of it, and then dig into individual parts to see how they can be broken down into quantum gates. So the algorithm is basically has two registers in it, which we're going to start in the all zero state. And as with the Deutsch-Jost algorithm, the first thing we do is do the Hadamard on every qubit, create a superposition of everything. Hadamard everything in the first register. So let's see. So let me. Let me put this as step one. But step one. No, sorry, I guess this is step one. This is step one, and this is step two. So step one, we have 0, 0. And at step two, we now have sum over A in the first register, A, and 0 in the second register. OK, so far, so good. Step three, we're going to calculate in the second register x to the A mod n.
Are there two?
So each of these is supposed to be multiple qubits. I'm just drawing three here and two here. They're each registers.
Oh,
so these zeros are supposed to be multiple zeros and multiple zeros. But exactly how many, I don't want to get into the details right now anyway. Not sure how much detail I'm going to get with that. OK, so this is going to be step three. And what do we have now? Well, at step three, we have now an entangled state between A and x to the A mod n. So x, remember, is something some classical value that we chose randomly. Well, we chose randomly in the context of using it to factor. But for period finding, this is just happens to be the function that we're calculating. So if you wanted to do period finding more generally, this would be calculating your function of A and putting it in this ancilla register. OK? And then for step four, which is actually not really needed, but makes it a lot clearer what's going on, we're going to measure the second register. OK? And so what that means here is that we get the result z, which is, sorry, x to the a, or some a, but it's also equal to x to the a plus j times r, where r is the period. Therefore, the state now is just the state of the first register, and it's the sum over j of a0 plus jr. I guess we can say this is a0. Okay? So there's a0 is arbitrary, right? Because we're summing over all the multiples here. So I guess the way I've written it, a0 could be the smallest value that has this property. And so what this looks like, kind of in terms of a wave function, is going to be something like this. Okay? And the interval between these spikes is r. And the first one is at a0, and the second one is a0 plus r, third one a0 plus 2r, and so on. Okay? And so then the next step is I do the Fourier transform. And that's the Fourier transform mod n. The discrete Fourier transform. So what is the Fourier transform as a unitary? So I'm taking A, and I'm getting sum over B omega to the AB B, where omega is an nth root of unity. All right, this is not mod n. That's wrong. This is mod 2 to the little n, where there's little n qubits here. Okay? And the number of qubits here needs to be big enough. So n is going to be, the 2 to the n is going to be bigger than big N. And it's actually going to have to be a lot bigger than big N. But what we need here is only enough space to hold some value mod N, big N. So this is about log N qubits, ceiling of log N, base 2. Yeah. So this is step 5. And so for step 5, what's the state that we have? So we have sum over j, sum over b, omega to the a0 plus jr times b, b. And we can rearrange things. So this is just rewriting this. I've taken out the omega to the a0b part when I switch the order of the sums. And then the jrb part is the interesting part. So I expanded omega is 2 pi I over 2 to the n. And then put the r at the bottom for reasons that will be clear in a moment. And then here you have this j times b phase. So what we want to do next in this is to let's see. is to so the only J appears here. And so if B is some multiple of 2 to the n over r, well, okay, let's see. So let's simplify by assuming that r divides 2 to the n. Okay? So when that's true, then 2 to the n over r is an integer. And when b is a multiple of that integer, then these things will cancel and we'll just get e to the 2 pi I times an integer. So this will just be 1. And we add up 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1, 1. Okay? Okay, and so we're going to let alpha equal 2 to the n over r. And if b is c times alpha, then sum e to the 2 pi I j b over alpha is just going to be 2 pi, is just going to be a sum over 1. So it's going to be, it's some constant. Which is going to get absorbed in this normalization, but I guess it's alpha here. But if b is not equal to c times alpha, then when we take this sum, we're getting, so it's the sum over j, remember. So we're gonna get either 2 pi I times something over something non, you know, there's some non-trivial thing in the denominator here. So it's some phase. And we get all multiples of that phase. You know, we may go around many times, we may go around just once. But the point is, we're taking multiples of this phase summed around the circle. And so they're going to all cancel out, and you get 0. And so the upshot is that the only things in this simplifying case assumption, the only things that we're left with are multiples of alpha. And so that's what this becomes. This becomes sum over b omega to the ab times, sum over c, a0 c alpha times c alpha. Okay. And then the step 6 is to measure. And once I measure this, I'm going to get C alpha for random C. Okay. So this phase here doesn't matter anymore because we're just measuring right away. And we're just getting some random multiple of 2 to the n over r. So what's happened is the Fourier transform has taken us from this thing with period, you know, spikes of period r. And the Fourier transform gives you something of also periodic, but importantly, starting at 0. Right? And so this initial shift has gone into the phase. And the period of this is 2 to the n over r, basically. OK? And so then there's actually a step 7, because this is not immediately telling us what the period is. So let's see. So step 7 is then a classical post-processing step, or really a way to basically, you run this a few times. And now we have C1 alpha, C2 alpha, C3 Z3 alpha, and maybe a few more. And the odds are, and C1, C2, C3 are just random numbers. It could be anything. So what we can do is we can find the GCD of these things. And the GCD will probably be alpha, right? After only two, you know, maybe there's a good chance it's still, they still have some common factor other than alpha. But after 3, 4, 5, that becomes increasingly unlikely. Okay? So once you've done that, you found alpha, which is 2 to the n over r, and therefore r, which is 2 to the n over alpha. Okay? Okay. So, So now there's basically three things that I want to explain in more detail that I skipped over. So the first one is kind of straightforward, but not totally obvious, which is how do you do this modular exponentiation efficiently? Second is how do you do the Fourier transform? And the third, which is also kind of important, is what if we don't have this assumption? What if R is not a factor of 2 to the n? Okay. I don't think I'm going to get to them all today. Probably I can do the modular exponentiation at this point. And then we'll do the other two tomorrow. Okay, but before I do that, let me just point out that this step 4, I commented that it was not necessary. And you'll see that we don't actually ever use this measurement result in the rest of the algorithm, right? So what's going on here? Well, the thing is that measuring it here made it clear that we had a state that looked like this. If we don't measure, what we actually have is an entangled state between this and another register that says how much. Well, that doesn't say how much, but it kind of implies how much there's been a shift. Right? It's hard to go from the value of this measurement result to figure out what A0 is. That would be basically period finding again. But we don't actually need to know that later on, because the Fourier transform turns that into a phase, which then vanishes. Okay. So it's only convenient when describing it to say that we do this measurement. If you're actually doing the algorithm, you don't have to bother. Okay. You just, at this point, you take this register and you throw it away. Okay. Okay, modular exponentiation. Well, before I do that, are there questions on the overview here? Okay. So how do we do the modular exponentiation? So really, this is going to be a classical algorithm, right? Because we're computing just a classical function. But we have to do it on superposition, so we have to do it out of quantum gates. And we are interested in how long it takes, right? Because it's going to affect the running time of the algorithm as a whole. So, so x is fixed. So what we're going to do is we're going to classically pre-calculate x squared, x to the fourth, up to x to the 2 to the n minus 1. And while this is a very high power, an exponentially high power, is you don't have to individually multiply x by itself. And this is all mod 2 to the n. Sorry, mod big N. You don't have to multiply by itself 2 to the n minus 1 times, because, you know, well, to get x squared, you multiply x times x. Right, that's one multiplication. Then to get x to the fourth, you multiply x squared times x squared. And x to the eighth is x to the fourth times x to the fourth, and so on. Right, so just repeated squaring will get you all of these things. So that's n minus 1. This is n minus 1 multiplications of log n bit numbers. So the next step is, this part has to be done with quantum gates. Well, yeah, this part does have to be done with quantum gates. So we have A, the power that we want to use, and we write it as sum over I, AI, 2 to the n minus, well, n minus 1 minus I. Okay? This is just the binary expansion of A. Then we can take A0 to A x the A n minus 1, x squared the A n minus 2, x to the fourth the A n minus 3, and so on. The last one is x to the 2 to the n minus 1 to the a0. Okay? So what we're going to do is we're going to take the first bit of this binary expansion, the bit a n minus 1, and we use it to add either x or not. Right? If it's 0, we don't add anything here. And if it's I guess we add x here if it's 0. And if, we add 1 here if it's 0. And if it's 1, then we add x here. And similarly here, we add x squared if this bit is 1, and x to the fourth to the third register if this bit is 1, and so on. Okay? So this is just straightforward, basically, you know, controlled addition gates. And so this step requires n additions, also of log n bit numbers. So then the next thing we do is we multiply together all of these things. So these are going to be extra ancilla registers. Of course, we're doing all this arithmetic mod n. And so now we have our additional register is x to the a n minus 1 plus 2 a n minus 2 plus 4 a n minus 3 plus dot, 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 2 to the n minus 1 a 0. And then we have these additional registers here, minus 1, dot, dot, dot. OK. And then, so how many are here? So this is, again, n minus 1 multiplications. And then what we do is we uncompute the ancillas by doing this step again, right? So that's, again, n additions. Yeah, I guess I made this n minus 1 multiplications by using this register here. So maybe we'll call this second. Okay? Okay, so adding this up, we have basically 2n additions of log n bit numbers and 2n minus 1 multiplications. Although part of that can be done purely classically. We still have n minus 1 multiplications of log n bit numbers. Now, adding together two log n bit numbers in the obvious way takes about log n steps, right? Because you know how to add, right? You add the lowest bits and you have to keep track of the carries. But you just go through them one by one. Multiplying is a bit harder, right? Because like log multiplication, you have to multiply each bit of one number by each bit of the other number. So multiplication, in the obvious way, takes log n squared operations. Now it turns out that there's fast multiplication algorithms that can go faster. But if we do this, then we would get this whole time is O of little n log n squared. So let's see. So if you use fast multiplication algorithms that are better than long multiplication, So as it happens, n is going to be O of log n. So this is O of n cubed. And so if you use a fast multiplication, you can get this down to O of n squared log n log log n. And you know, it's possible there's even faster multiplications that happen. So basically, it's somewhere between n squared and n cubed is the time to do this micro exponentiation. So, are there questions on that? So this is going to be it for today, and then tomorrow we'll come back with the Fourier transform, which is more interesting because it's more quantum. And then the full analysis in the case where you don't have that simplifying assumption. Okay?